Well, over the last 2 weeks, we have been going over an article that Google Gemini generated for me, and over a series of questions, and it was over the statement that James, the brother of Jesus, had made in Acts chapter 15, which was the prophets all agree from the Old Testament that the Gentiles were always going to be accepted into God's kingdom. And then he quotes a passage from Amos. And anyway, since he mentioned, he didn't talk about any other prophets that also talked about Gentiles being allowed to enter into God's kingdom, but he just said that there were all the prophets, so there's more than just Amos. So, but I didn't get any, Kaufman didn't elaborate on it, and the Contending for the Faith commentator, he didn't even mention it. And so I went to Google AI, and over, I don't know, it was probably 4 or 5 questions that we asked back and forth, and came up with an eight-page article that further explained and listed the various prophets, which included the, it listed them right off, and it came up with the prophets from the Old Testament that acknowledged and prophesied that the Gentiles would be able to enter God's kingdom, not just the Israelites only. And it was the initial list he came up with is Isaiah, Zechariah, Jonah, Malachi, Jeremiah, Hosea, and Joel. And with that initial, I believe that's 7 prophets, he left out Amos, which here over the last 2 weeks, we've covered probably 3 or 4 other questions that we bantered back and forth with. And so then we finally, after it answered this, I asked him, this Google AI said, "Why did you not include Amos originally?" I had to ask you about him. So I had to ask him, maybe that was like the 3rd question that came in. So, well, what about Amos? You left him out. Anyway, so now I wanted to ask the Google AI why he left out Amos. And this is what it came up with. It said, "That is a fair point. Amos is often hidden in plain sight when it comes to this topic because of how his book is structured and how his words were eventually understood. I likely overlooked him initially because Amos is primarily known as the prophet of doom. Out of his 9 chapters, almost 8.5 are relentless warnings of judgment against Israel and surrounding nations for social injustice. The prophecy about the Gentiles is tucked into a final few verses of the very last chapter, making it easy to miss compared to Isaiah, who mentions the Gentiles throughout his entire book. Here is why Amos is often omitted or debated in these lists. First, it came up with the original Hebrew versus the Septuagint explanation. And what he's going to mention here is that there was different wording in the Hebrew text versus for the passage of Amos that James quotes, versus the Septuagint translation, which was the Greek translation of the Hebrew text. And how the Septuagint came into being was after the Greek Empire came into its full establishment, and which it didn't take long. It was known famously historically how Alexander the Great, over a period of maybe it was 10 years, something like that, and maybe mostly over maybe 3 years, that he went all the way from Greece and he ultimately ended right on the west end of India, where he was stopped, and then they went He didn't go back home, but he went back to what was the old Babylonian Empire, modern day Iraq, which, but at that time of what had just, he'd recently conquered was the Persians. And so that was a Persian stronghold. And he went right into the palace of what used to be the Babylonian kings, which I guess it was the exact facility that King Nebuchadnezzar maybe had built. And I think it was right there with the famous Babylonian gardens where he went into. But then the Persians were all there at that time, and that he had just conquered them. But he had gone back there, and then he died. Anyway, so that's just a brief history on the Greeks. But what he did by spreading the Greek Empire all the way from, let me get this map to show, from Greece and Macedonian. Actually, Alexander the Great was Macedonian. We think of them all as the same people, but they did not consider themselves as the same people. Alexander the Great was from Macedon, here in Macedonia, and here, just to get our bearings, here is Jerusalem, here is North Africa, and here is Italy with Rome that would be the next power that would take over the Greek Empire. And but he was from Macedon. And then here's actually Greece here, but then they ended up merging. And Alexander the Great, they ended up, I don't know if it's as much as a war, but they merged. And he took over all of Greece. So then all of this was now known as Greece, although I think Alexander the Great always referred to himself as Macedonian more than Greek. But regardless, they all spoke the Greek language. And that is what is important here with this text about this Septuagint. And but Alexander the Great, he conquered all of this, what was known as Asia Minor, modern day Turkey. They conquered all of that. They conquered all of this Palestine area here with Jerusalem all the way up Antioch. They conquered all of that. They conquered North Africa. And I don't know how far west he went in North Africa, but it was Egypt was the main stronghold that he ended up conquering. And he even founded a city known that he named himself after himself as Alexandria. And then they went from after conquering all of this territory, then... And they were fighting the Medo-Persians, so they backed them off all the way back to the east, right to their stronghold, where Medo-Persia was from this area and off of this map here to the northeast even more. But this is the old Media, and then but this is modern-day Iran, is this area. And this area here is modern-day Iraq, the old Babylonian Empire. So then once they came out of Egypt and came up through Jerusalem, they went right through the old Mesopotamia area. And there was one major battle, from what I understand, probably right in here, maybe somewhat west of where Nineveh used to be. And then they got the king of the Persians on the run. And he ran off to the east, and he was going to go back to his Persian Empire, and going to leave because they'd been conquered out of this old Babylonian district and area. So he was just going back to his stronghold, but he didn't get a chance because Alexander's advisors wanted. They thought, well, that was just pretty good. You know, we've got now all the old Babylonian Empire territory now, but that wasn't good enough. Alexander kept running after him, but ultimately, it seemed, if I remember right, it was his that the Persian king's generals, that some of them or his soldiers assassinated him, knowing that Alexander was coming right after him. And so that king was already killed by the time Alexander the Great caught up with him. And then they went from there and went on to India. And they had one battle, and it was a fierce battle, which the Alexander won, but then his generals and soldiers had given completely up, and they were spent, I believe it was 10 years from my memory, that they had fought constantly with this fierce, which was the world power at the time, the Persian Empire, one of the greats of all time. And they had completely conquered them. And then a report that I had heard, I don't know if it's exactly accurate, but what I'd heard is his scouts, Alexander's scouts, got up on a tall mountain and looked going east into India. And it was soldiers, army after army, just in every valley as far as the eye could see from this tall mountain. And so that report came back, and those soldiers did not have the heart in them. And so that's when they came back to, it was actually the Shushan area and the palace and all. It was right where the account of Esther is. And that's where Alexander the Great went back in plans of just resting here and staying here in this fine palace area of the old Babylonian Empire, and whatever else the Persians had done with that area. And it was luscious and luxurious. And, but then, ultimately, they were going to go back to the Macedon and Greek area. But he got some kind of mysterious illness, and he died. And so then that was the end of him. And then the Greek Empire was split into four kingdoms, just as the book of Daniel had prophesied that it would be. But what that did, that was enough that the Greek language was spread over this whole massive territory, all the way to India, all the way North Africa, and all of this part of Europe, and then modern day Iraq and Iran. Okay, so this Septuagint came in, and this was all something like 300 BC, and the Israelites and the Jews. This Greek language was so pervasive that the Jews found themselves to where the people could no longer even read, and I think not even speak, but they definitely could not read the Hebrew language anymore. They could only read the Greek language. And so you had all of these Jews, the Israelites, and they were illiterate of the Hebrew text, the Old Testament. So the Jewish hierarchy got together, seeing this massive problem that had come up, knowing that their people needed to know the Word of God, and they were illiterate with the Hebrew, and I guess they could not teach them that, so they decided what they would do. Instead of a mass education program to teach everybody, you know, all the, again, these descendants that had forgotten how to read Hebrew or never were taught, they decided to get a group of 70 Greek and Hebrew scholars that were Israelites, and they translated the Hebrew text into Greek. And that is known as the Septuagint. And it comes from the Greek root word sept, meaning seven or 70. That's why it's called the Septuagint, because there were 70 scholars that translated the Hebrew text into Greek. And then, as a result, then all of these Israelites could now read the what we call the Old Testament. They just called it the Scriptures. And because that's all that there was at the time. But then, so But how this comes into play with this passage of Amos that James quoted. James quoted from the Septuagint, which translated a word differently from what the Hebrew scholars, the Masoretes, had translated some centuries and whatever before. And so I'll read what AI said is the reasoning for some of this misunderstanding, and which also explains, in at least in part, why the Israelites and these Pharisees who have now become Christians had missed and misunderstood that the Gentiles were supposed to and always were going to be part of God's kingdom. And this is the explanation that in the passage that James uses in Acts 15. But anyway, a Google AI said about the original Hebrew text versus the Septuagint explanation. In the original Hebrew, which is the Masoretic text, it was translated by the Masoretes and those scribes, Amos 9:12 says, Israel will possess the remnant of Edom. And this sounds like a military conquest of a neighboring enemy. When the Septuagint translated that Hebrew word, when the Septuagint translated that Hebrew word as the remnant of mankind instead of the remnant of Eden, the Septuagint scholars translated that Hebrew word instead of as Edom, they translated it as mankind. And then it was understood that the Gentiles would be expected to seek God and be allowed to seek God. Now, the Google AI said, then it was understood at that time that the Gentiles would be expected to seek God. I'm going to say they completely missed that, even though they should have understood it that way. They obviously didn't, because the Septuagint was written over about a 150-year period. So I think it was like from 250 to maybe 100 B.C. And so it had been fully translated and copied and dispersed through the population for well over 100 years by the time that this was taking place in 50 A.D. So it could have been even up to 200 years. But James had to point this out to them, that it would be this remnant of mankind referring to the Gentiles that would be allowed to enter into God's kingdom. Okay, so, but this was one reason why the Google AI said that Amos is a lot of times left out, and why it left out Amos as being one of these prophets that prophesied that the Gentiles would be part of God's kingdom. Then, second point that it came up with is a last-minute hope. Because the shift to restoration only happens in the final five verses of the book of Amos, because the first eight and a half is doom and destruction, and it was Amos was a prophet of a strong, stern warning to the Israelites that they better be righteous and be faithful to God, otherwise doom was on the horizon. But then, only in the final five verses that it shifted to this hope of, well, now the Gentiles will be able to enter God's kingdom. But it says, because of that, many readers focused on his themes of justice and wrath rather than global salvation for the Gentiles and all of mankind. And then the third point is, in many ways, James rediscovered Amos's significance for the Gentiles. Before the Jerusalem Council in Acts 15, Amos wasn't the first prophet people thought of for Gentile inclusion. James had to specifically point it out to settle a heated theological debate. Now, this is a very good point made here. there was no rebuttal, and it left the Pharisees, former Pharisees that have now become Christians, but they were false teaching that the Gentiles had to become Jewish proselytes. They had to convert to Judaism before they could become Christians. And the main point of contention was over circumcision, that all of the men, Gentile men, had to be circumcised before they could be baptized and become Christians. And that's where now Paul, James, John, and Peter were all pushing back against these false teachers, saying no. And then this was James. He was the final one to speak. There were five different speaking parts in Acts 15 of this meeting. And James, being the last one to speak, he brings this point that ultimately shuts down negativity or a pushback that they were receiving from these false teachers. They didn't have a leg to stand on. Okay, so that was that reason and explanation of why the Google AI missed Amos originally, because he only talked about the Gentiles becoming part of God's kingdom in the final few verses of a 9-chapter book. Okay, so this last question actually came from Google Gemini, and it said, would you like to know more about why James specifically chose Amos's words over a more obvious prophet like Isaiah? And so I said yes, and then it gave me a 2-page answer, which was, James's use of Amos in Acts 15 was a deliberate and strategic choice to address this specific theological crisis. While Isaiah spoke of Gentiles generally, Amos provided the legal framework needed to settle a debate about Jewish law. James chose Amos over other prophets for several key reasons. First, Gentiles as Gentiles, meaning that Gentiles would be allowed to enter God's kingdom as Gentiles and not Jewish proselytes or Jewish converts first. The central debate was whether Gentiles had to become Jews through circumcision to be saved. And then part of the explanation and the passage from Amos 9, 11, and 12 was the tabernacle of David would be restored. And James quoted this passage, Amos 9, 11, and 12, from the Septuagint translation and not from the old Masoretic Hebrew translation, and which describes God rebuilding the fallen shelter or the tabernacle of David. So the tabernacle of David would be rebuilt or restored. And AI now has had a different take on what that meant than what Kaufman had, and I'll remind us of what Kaufman's take on that passage was, and then I'll read now, though, what AI, this is a very valid point, and seems like to me that both are very valid, and I'll say both are correct, but it says, unlike the physical temple, the Solomon's temple, and then the one that was had been rebuilt and in the process of being rebuilt, but was actually finished in this 50 AD time frame. It had just gotten finished. But while Jesus was alive in 30 AD, it had still not been finished. Of course, Solomon's temple was destroyed in 586 BC by the Babylonian Empire. And then it was hundreds of years before they started making progress on rebuilding that temple. And then once they, then King Herod, I believe it was something like 100 BC, there was a King Herod that was not from the lineage of David, but he was the king of the Jews, appointed by the Roman Empire. And anyway, he started to rebuild what had been the destroyed Solomon's temple, and it was a source of Jewish pride. We know that from Matthew 24, Mark 13, and Luke 21, when the apostles are bragging about how nice this temple was, but it was not even completed during that time of 30 AD. It wasn't completed until 50 or so AD, which is exactly where we are here in Acts 15. And so it had just been completed here at this time, or very close to this time to be completed, when James quoted this from Amos about this fallen or rebuilding of the of David's tabernacle versus this temple that was here in Jerusalem. And so it said, unlike the physical temple that had just been rebuilt, which had a wall of separation keeping Gentiles out, David's original tent was a simple structure that allowed for direct worship. James used this to show that the Messianic kingdom was designed to include Gentiles as Gentiles, not as Jewish proselytes. And the point that the Google Gemini is making here is, and we know this even from the biblical example, that the Gentiles were not allowed to enter the inner courtyard. There was an outer courtyard and then an inner courtyard that Gentiles were not able to come into. And then, of course, then there was the temple structure and then the Holy of Holies that only the high priest was able to enter only one time a year. And there was an outer court first that the general population and the Gentiles could enter, but then there was at least one gate, maybe multiple gates, and there was a sign that was posted at the gate that said, any Gentile that enters through this gate will be killed. Well, that comes into play in Acts 21 and 22 when Paul is falsely accused of allowing Luke and Silas, who were Gentiles, to enter that inner courtyard, and which they had not entered it, but that was the false accusation, and then it ultimately ended in, they were going to use that to kill Paul, but the Roman soldiers saved him, and then he ultimately is in prison for 4 years after that. But this is the contrast. David's temple never had such a separation to keep the Gentiles out. The Gentiles were, there was no courtyard that the Gentiles were not allowed to come into. And so this point is that, and thought that Amos, the fulfillment of this prophecy was that where it had, tabernacle structure, the tent structure of David, would be restored to where the Gentiles would freely be able to come and enter it and be associated with it, whereas the temple structure there in Jerusalem was not. It was on a term of death if you entered into it as a Gentile. And so that was what Google AI came up with, which I was glad to hear that. That seemed like a very valid point. Now, Kaufman, we've gone over this at least once, maybe more than once. What his take on this was a more of a symbolic take instead of a physical take about David's physical temple. And Kaufman said, well, this temple of David being restored is obviously God's kingdom, which is an extremely valid point also. I really think that both of these are fulfillments and like two sides of the same coin and has multiple fulfillments here. But Kaufman's point was that the David's lineage had as reign of king through his lineage had ended in 586 BC when the Babylonians destroyed the temple at Jerusalem, and it was King Zedekiah was the last Jewish or Israelite, it'd be the Jewish king in the line of David. And until 30 AD, then the Messiah is crucified, and then the day of Pentecost comes in Acts 2. Christ's kingdom is established, and then Christ is reign. From that point, started to reign as king over his kingdom, and then, of course, will reign forever. And then Kaufman's point is that was the restoration of David's temple, of David's tent or David's tabernacle. So those are the two takes on and explanations for that passage that I've run across. Then it mentions another point here. James likely quoted from the Septuagint, which offered a clearer global application than the standard Hebrew text. And it talks again about this difference in translation from the Hebrew text and the Septuagint. In the remnant of mankind is translated in the Septuagint, but it says in the Hebrew text, the passage says Israel will possess the remnant of Edom, a local enemy, versus the remnant of mankind. And the change of wording, the Septuagint translates this as the remnant of mankind might seek the Lord. This specific phrasing made Amos's words a smoking gun that clearly proved that God wanted all of humanity to seek him, not just Israel, to conquer neighbors. And by him saying this was the smoking gun, it completely stopped all of this aggressive posturing that these false teachers had been doing and the argument. They didn't have a leg to stand on after James quoted from the book of Amos. And then this a third point from Amos 9:12, all the nations called by my name. Amos includes this phrase, all the nations upon whom my name is called. This phrase suggested that God had already placed his name, his ownership and identity on these people before they ever followed Jewish laws. And this perfectly harmonizes with Peter's statement that the Holy Spirit had already fallen on the Gentiles of Cornelius's household without them being circumcised. And that is the point that Peter had already used to shut down these false teachers. That, no, God had already had me go up to Caesarea from Joppa, and they, Cornelius and his household, God had them performing miracles, which was speaking languages that they had never learned and couldn't possibly have learned instantly. And we did not circumcise them, and we baptized them to make them, for them to become Christians. And so God said from Acts 10, from this time of Cornelius and his household in Caesarea, that he was allowing the Gentiles to enter into God's kingdom. And here they were some 10 or so years removed from that, and now they're reverting back and wanting to forget that of what happened. So Peter had to remind them what he had done, Peter and his associates that were with him, they did not circumcise any of those Gentiles before they were baptized to become Christians. And then the final phrasing is the rebuilding versus replacing. By using Amos, James showed that the restoration of David's kingdom through Jesus the Messiah automatically triggered the inclusion of the Gentiles, just as the prophets had prophesied. So that was the end of this article that I'd gotten from Google Gemini. And so we just lack the last few verses, 10 verses or so in Acts 15. And Lord willing, we will plan to finish that possibly next week. If not, then it'll be after 2 weeks is what we'll plan. So at this time.